Well, good afternoon to this second seminar of the afternoon. My name is Chris Gilson, and I'm the managing editor of the British Politics and Policy at LSE blog. Patrick Dunleavy is the general editor. He's here as well. So we'll be having a chat this afternoon about improving academic communication through blogging and the various different types of blogs that one can have and how one can do that. Now, just as we start, I'd like to do a quick survey just for sort of selfish purposes. Can I guess sort of have a show of hands of people who show your hands if you read blogs regularly? Okay, most of you. Show your hand if you have a blog or you contribute to a blog. Okay, well, that's quite a few. Now show your hand if you've updated your blog in the last month. Okay, so maybe sort of half. Okay, well, we'll keep that in mind as we go through because that becomes quite important. So the structure of this presentation, we'll look at sort of academic communication as it now for the most part. Then we'll move on to academic blogging and the advent of multi-author academic blogs as in contrast to single-author blogs. Then we'll talk a bit about using social media and approaches to using social media. And then we'll look at multi-author blogs here at the LSE and elsewhere. I'm obviously at the end very interested to hear your questions and comments, especially as it sounds already like a lot of you are actually bloggers. And so it'd be interesting to compare practice and have a chat about that. So, academics going online isn't a particularly new phenomenon. We've had the internet now for some decades, email since the early 90s. So, we've been able to. Are we on the. Wait a second. Sorry, I'm on the wrong slide. Sorry, I apologize. So, for the most part, academic communication is about journal articles, conference proceedings, books, which can be very high priced, book reviews. These tend to be read by quite a few people and rarely picked up by the media unless you're sort of a rock star academic, as we've sort of discussed in previous sessions. The text of these books and closed web articles is actually really not very accessible to those who don't have journal access, so people who aren't at universities, alumni, that sort of thing. They're not on the open web. They're very one way of communicating by experts and for experts, so they're not accessible to the wider world. But social scientists, as we know, are observers who need to communicate their observations to the world in a timely way. Much of this knowledge and input goes unapplied because of the very long timelines for outputs and a lack of adaptation or translation. So we can talk about sort of periods of months or years between when the research actually occurs and when it is disseminated to a newspaper, if you're lucky. So the question is, how do we change or complement the traditional model? So we can look at academic blogging in the event of multi-author academic blog, or MUBs for short. So going back to the point I was making earlier, academics online aren't new. We've had it for a while. But academic blogging is different because for the most part, a lot of journals online, forums and mailing lists, they tend to have longer articles, sort of 5,000 to 8,000 words, much more like a traditional journal article. This is something new and something different. So for academic blogging, we're talking short articles, 300 words, 1,200 words, measured in paragraphs as opposed to pages. Easy to share by email and social networks. So with one click of a button, you could send an email or send out to Twitter. Searchable on the open web, so again, one Google search. And then this ties into what we were talking about in the previous session and this morning in terms of having short titles. Hence Google a bit, but we'll get onto that later. So the content can be personal as well as academic. So often, various types of blogs, you have a personal comment on a various issue with the person's own style, which can then be interesting to readers. Also, the other thing which a lot of academics can be reticent about is there are instant comments and feedback. You can find out what people think of your research and work instantly, and that can be experts and members of the general public. So the great thing about academic blogging is anyone can actually do it. WordPress offers free hosting with preset themes and that sort of thing. So does Blogger. You can do it if you're web savvy, hosting on your own web server or even on an institutional server as we do here at the LSE. Often some bloggers, say like Paul Krugman, actually have blogs that are hosted within media. Like, for example, his is the New York Times. See here, he's being syndicated by them. So often the media will co-opt popular academics and get them to blog. So as we said, dissemination is immediate, and there's a spectrum of offerings. So from any level, for an academic who blogs occasionally, all the way up to people like Paul Krugman. Okay. And just some other examples here, which we've sort of been through a bit this morning. Charlie Beckett's Polis is an example of a multi-author blog, which is led by a single person. He has his interns blogging on there. And then we have Connor Gitti's Rights Future, which is a collaborative publishing project. He's written a book about human rights and building that together with comments from different people. We have, from sort of more of a science point of view, we've got
classics,
that's right. We have Mary Beard's blog, A Don's Life. You can see that then is hosted by The Times as well. So single author blogs then, they've gone massively in popularity with authors. So for example, the Warwick blog more or less 7,000 blogs with 140,000 entries. You see that's their opening screen there. You see they've got many thousands of blogs and work there. But
so where do you go first?
The issue with single author blogs is about updating. And we sort of had half of you have blogs, half again updated in the last month. So that's an example again, showing just here about updating. So at least 75% of blogs worldwide are dead or dormant, although I actually have seen research that says up to 90%. So certainly the vast majority of blogs are moribund. And so one of the reasons for this, and we saw again this morning, was who has time to blog. Time pressures really stop us from communicating outwards, and blogging is included in that. You can see Colin Talbot's Why Hard Watch. I don't know if you can read it at the bottom, but it says, sorry for the absence of post.
I've been for a while. I've been offline due to domestic issues involving the health service, hence the next blog.
So he is using that for a new blog, perhaps. But you can see a lot, if you have a single author blog, if you aren't able to do it consistently, that can have affect your readership and those sorts of issues. So you must be able to do a blog effectively, be able to produce content on it, run on a regular basis. As we said, that's really difficult to do. So content is king, and if it's a blog that's a vanity project that's sort of rarely updated, it won't survive. Now, in political blog terms, some are very popular, like Guido Fawkes, although he has actually co-opted a lot of other people to help run his blog as well. Most single author blogs are shutting down or joining in with corporate bloggers. Ian Dale, who was one of the kings of political blogging, has actually joined a new collaborative project with 60 other authors, I believe. So even the top level political bloggers aren't necessarily being able to engage on their own anymore. And part of this, we feel, is that the appetite for personal commentary has actually shifted to Twitter. Because as a more of a live blogging or a life blogging sort of effort. And if you're able to produce comments on Twitter with 140 characters, people don't have time to read the longer blogs and they'll just go to Twitter. So what's the solution? Well, it's multi-author academic blogs. Now, it pretty much does what it says on the tin. It's a blog with multiple contributors covering many topics or subjects, posting reliably and regularly, so readers know to return. If they know that you're going to have two posts a day or one post a day or three posts a day, they will come back and they will read you. You can have a lot of flexible formats, so you can have a top-level blog, for example, like LSE's British Politics and Policy blog. So that blog has 200 authors. We post every day or twice or sometimes three times a day, even more if there's a political campaign going on in an election. You can have smaller multi-author blogs for single departments or networks or research groups posting weekly or bi-weekly. And again, as we discussed before, comments on social media can help to build a community. And the great thing about these is that in terms of immediate impact, you can track your readership with Google Analytics. And that means you can track everything down to, I can tell you how many people from the BBC were reading a certain blog post at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So you have incredible levels of market segmentation by country, by everything. So you can immediately, as an academic, find out who is reading your blog and how they arrived at it. So a way of disseminating this is through Twitter and Facebook. And the technology is now at a point where you're able to post a blog and that will automatically be sent to Twitter and to Facebook. So that can promote the blog and greatly extend its reach and visibility. So your blog may be read by a few thousand a day, but then that potential is even more increased because you have several thousand followers of the Twitter site. So while, as a personal blog, if you were a single author academic blog, that would only go out to a few hundred, but if you're benefiting from the fact that the blog has a wide readership, adds in a level of interactivity, and also encourages discussion and rapid correction. I can tell you, if you get anything wrong, including spelling mistakes on your blog, your community will let you know about it, that's for sure. So you can see it's an example of a Twitter page. You have various conversations and threads going on. You can see people who've mentioned you, people who've retweeted what you've had to say. So it's all very interactive. And similarly with Facebook, which is the next one. again, you have the top level post that's gone up, and then comment streams going down, and various similar things. You can see the number of people who like the site, and so you can get a really quick way of people feeding back. So what sort of style do you need as a multi-author blog? Well, sort of relates to what we've already talked about. Short paragraphs, simple language, front load the narrative. A lot of academics and journal articles tend to put a lot of the main points or the conclusion as a bang at the end. Well, because a lot of people only read the first two or three paragraphs, if they even get that far, you need to front load the narrative, have them your main points at the start, and then continue down with explanatory points and references, if you're going to have them. Use narrative titles, written by the team who runs the blog itself rather than the author. 6 to 10 words is great, if possible. Sometimes we're a little more, but 6 to 10 would be is fantastic. That can then go out as a tweet in this 140 characters and then get spread around virally around the web. Introductory paragraphs, sort of a shorter abstract that talks about what the author is writing, what the main points are, and introduces the author as well. Have simple, clear charts and diagrams as well. As they say, picture tells 1,000 words. And in some cases, it certainly does with a blog. Give methods information where it's needed and in context. If you have another research report that has your methods, link to that, because interest readers will go and read that as well. Again, a Creative Commons license does help your content to spread as well. Creative Commons, I'm sure most of you know, is a way of distributing your work without having people needing to ask you that you can they can copy it. So there's a lot of different ways you can do multi-author blogs. For example, Social Europe is actually linked to a journal as well, and that they complement each other. Depending on the size, it can generate massive amounts of Twitter followers. British Politics and Policy LSE is just over 4,000 and growing. Social Europe has 10,000. You can make very good use of podcasts, video, rich media, ways of showing things that are a little more beyond text as well. As I said, there's various different ways of doing it. The conversation is in a newspaper style. Australian Policy Online is an indexer.
So let's look at some of those.
Social Europe.
Run by a guy called Henning Meyer, who's at LSE. It's a sort of left of center European politics blog, which has very good interviews and sort of lead columnists. And if you page down, it's got lots more content on there.
Just before you check, as you can see, it's really well integrated with Facebook and Twitter. So if you want to see what their presence is in each of these areas, YouTube, Vimeo, which is a video provider, it's all that you can click straight through. And indeed, just going back to what we were talking about, titles and intros, you see the picture of the academic, the short title, easily Facebookable, and sort of 4 or 5 lines of what it's about. So instantly you know if you want to read one of those posts right away. So it's really, really specific.
Okay, although I don't like political parties and the good society. It seems a bit vague to me.
So this is The Conversation, which is an Australian newspaper-style blog, but again, aggregates academic and expert comment in various areas, and got areas such as Facebook and facial recognition, scientists pinpointing why smoking kills the appetite. So this is a very cross-subject blog, incorporating the sciences and the social sciences. So they won't have any trouble creating content and getting people out, and then all will then benefit. All the academics and experts will then benefit.
But this is still a very academic creation. You can see it says, does matched funding give industry too much control over research? The experts respond. Well, what's the answer? That's what I'd like to say. So a narrative title would say it does or it doesn't. It wouldn't just ask the question. Similarly, scientists pinpoint why smoking kills the appetite. Well, why? So a narrative title means actually try and put the goods in the shop window. And this is sort of semi-academic.
I think the best thing to stress with a title is that if a reader doesn't even have time to read the article, they should be able to understand what you're saying just from the title. And that isn't easy. That's why you have to spend a great deal of time on your title and making sure it's going to disseminate. But that will do most of the work for you. If you can get people in with a title, then you've probably got them for a lot, or at least the first few paragraphs of the article. So it's really important to stress that.
And Australian Policy Online?
It's an index, as we said. Again, a different format, using maps.
What it mainly does is just index different aspects of Australian government policy and present them in a more intelligible and interesting way than the government manages to present them, which isn't too difficult, as in most countries.
So multi-author themed blogs are becoming more and more prevalent worldwide. There's quite a few at the LSE. Media has a blog. International Affairs has a new blog. There's a new Africa blog, which has just started up as of, I think, last week, which I encourage you to all go and look at. Oxford has one called Politics and Spies, which is very good, as is Nottingham's Ballots and Bullets. I'm sure there's those of you in the audience who run your own blogs, and we'll be quite happy to talk about them. So we'd like to hear from you, especially. Importantly, the internet isn't a zero-sum game, so it doesn't matter if each institution has its own multi-author blog. It will get read. Through the use of things like RSS feeds and email lists, people will pick up and read your blogs. They're not going to be reading it like they read a journal article. They're not going to be reading 8,000 words, but they will pick up 500 words, 800 words. So you doing it or you not, you shouldn't necessarily be dissuaded from doing it because you think that no one will read it because other blogs are being read. It will be read, especially if you have the content and you have the titles. So if we all do it, we all pitch in to better communicate knowledge to a wider audience, the whole result to everyone is beneficial. Because often, I mean, for example, in British politics and policy, a great many of our writers are actually not from the LSE. We have a huge number of contributors from other universities all over the world. So there's no reason why institutions should just stick to their own authors and researchers. It's great to have them as a base, but you can certainly have collaborative postings and indeed actually cross-post. So post something from Oxford to the LSE or Nottingham to the LSE or vice versa. More is better. So just looking more at sort of structural issues and getting them started. So we have to cope with a lot of academics who are reticent to do it and want to sort of write a 4,000 word article rather than a 1,200. We have a blog team here, and it's a really good model, and we actually are able to rewrite things that they've written and then sending it back to them. They retain final editorial control. And we've had an overwhelmingly good response in that way. A lot of academics are very keen for us to do it. It actually helps them learn as well how to reduce their content to a size that is more bloggable. Again, there's sort of issues with dealing with the press office and communications. Where does the responsibility for blogs lie? Does it lie with a research group? Does it lie with external relations? It can be quite a fraught process. Do you want to run your blog yourself in a department or group, or, you know, and then have that be smaller, or do you want to run it as an institutional blog? It's important issues. We find that faculty-wide and university-wide multi-author academic blogs are the best because they're able to aggregate large number of contributors and get one or two posts out a day, which is sort of, I think we feel, the minimum to have an institutional-sized blog that will get a lot of hits and sort of and justify itself. So as we said, collaborations between institutions and networking can help assembling a critical mass. So say you have a sort of half of your authors from your institution and then 25% from other institutions and 25% from think tanks or other sort of policy areas. So just in conclusion, professional standards of communication are changing in every walk of life, in every academism. We have to do things differently. They're getting shorter through Twitter, and who knows what's around the block after Twitter. Is it something in 20 characters? Is it something in 2 words? We don't know. It sounds facetious, but, you know, 10 years ago, if you'd said you have to translate your research into 140 characters, you'd have been laughed out of the room, and now they have to. So, you know, there are exceptions too, however. The 24-hour long news interviews to fill the space, that sort of thing. So it's good to have that content in the background, webcasts, podcasts, videocasts, that sort of thing, to sort of have especially for journalists, to have as an archive for them to use. So main research outputs need different versions, so you can have a journal guide. We're not saying don't write journal articles. It's write a journal article and do a blog and do a podcast and do a videocast, or get other people to help you to do these things and then disseminate that through. So even these distinctions may lapse. So, for example, free-to-read professional journals are opening up full details to everyone who's online. In fact, there's the National Academy of... I think it was one of the National Academies in the States has just released...
The National Academy Press.
Press, that's the one.
Publishing all its books online.
4,000 ePDFs are now online, which otherwise wouldn't have been. So the trend is going free. The trend is going open. So with 50% of each UK generation becoming graduates, universities needing alumni support, communicating expertly to graduates and alumni is set to be way more vital, hence the need for multi-author academic blogs.
Great. So let's hope some of you have got some queries and questions and things. Yes, starting Justin at the back. Yeah.
So just quick, who pays for it? it's not meant to be a question. It's, clearly you've got a very large fog where you bring people in. I asked a question in the previous session about what do you do with reputational risk, and you have an editor, which I presume is a full-time job.
Yeah.
So how do you persuade your institution to fund all that?
Well, luckily for us, we have some high for funding that has so far, and we're hoping to extend the blogging function in the future with Hive things. But of course, we have to compete with a lot of other calls on that funding. Yeah, but I agree, it's been very helpful to have some funding like that. It is very difficult. But you know, one of the things is your university may have, depending on how it's working and how good it is, it may have a large communications division that's doing not an awful lot. And you know, you could persuade them to free up some of that money and give it to the academics who actually know what they're doing in many cases.
Can I just add to that? I think, just in terms of thinking about communications departments, blogging is so ubiquitous now, and everyone does it, and that, you know, especially in the States, it's so common. It would be like asking 10 years ago, how do we pay for an events program? How do we pay for an outreach program? How do we pay for anything insert anything engaging with the public? This is just another way of engaging. I think there needs to be an institutional mindset, an institutional change in mindset, that this is just something we do as a university to engage.
This is British universities we're talking about.
I know.
But if you've got a website...
You have to start somewhere.
No,
think of a website as a very old-fashioned blog. That doesn't work. Sorry, Steve.
Just a comment, really. I mean, the blogosphere is a very... heterogeneous entity, and just some of the comments that you made there struck me as speaking to a very particular type of audience and a particular type of function. I mean, you talk about the way you write a blog, you use a very strong title, front loaded. I mean, you're talking about writing a newspaper article, basically, and I would just want to point out, obviously you don't have to do it that way, you might write whichever way you want. I try to follow the advice of Tim Radford, who used to write to the Garden for a long time, and basically the principle is nobody has to read the shit that you write, so you have to sort of catch them with every single sentence. The other thing is, I mean, so about who pays for it? Nobody pays me to do it. I don't do it on university time. Okay, I do it at evenings and weekends. My own blog, it's not affiliated to the university, and that's obviously universities are interested in this, particularly linking to the ref. But actually, I don't know if I would be entirely comfortable writing blog posts for the university. I would feel incumbent on me to sort of limit some of the remarks that I might otherwise make. I feel I have more independence and a bit more freedom. You know, I sort of, on my blog, I say I work at Imperial, but the opinions here are entirely my own, so I have a very important disclaimer there. And I think I enjoy a bit more freedom doing that. If I was writing a blog for the university, I would expect it to take, because, you know, they're the ones ultimately getting the benefit from it. I guess I would feel able to do it on university time, but I think certain constraints, although there is this thing called academic freedom, we all know that universities do take the best of their employers, say, employees, say, do.
How many blogs do you write a year on your blog?
I aim for about 3 or 4 a month, and so that's my frequency of posting. I never do this, I apologise for not doing blogs. You know, that's just me. My very first blog was, I said, I'm not going to apologise if I don't do it, but it's not going to happen. But a degree of regularity is absolutely vital for sort of nurturing and maintaining an audience. If you drop it, they'll drop you as well, so you know, that's absolutely right. So some degree of regularity, but you know, it's not every Wednesday morning.
So you've got to balance the freedom versus the workload. Because we would typically ask one of our blog authors to, you know, write for us 3 times a year. If we have 200 authors, then we've got 600 blogs. So we can do 2 a day. So all I'm saying is yours are a high commitment kind of model. It's not to say it's any less valid, but it's, you know, it's not really a model that we could all do and all prosper at doing.
Oh, absolutely. But I was making a point, there's scope for lots of different variety there.
Absolutely.
At the back?
Yeah.
Yes.
I was just going to say, in my experience, most academics aren't like you. In my experience, most academics really don't want to do this kind of stuff. and actually getting them to do it is quite a struggle. But if you provide them with the support of some really good comms people, and you've got your log team or whatever, if you give them the support of some good comms people, then they're prepared to, you know, input the material, somebody else makes it, you know, accessible and gets the language right and gets it out there, and makes sure that it happens on a regular basis. And I mean, where I am, I'm at Essex University, the Institute of Social and Economic Research, and, you know, we're really committed to that process and trying to just make sure there is a continuous, regular feed happening of the research that's going on. Left to the individual academics in the institute, it would not happen.
Mm.
So I think it's real, but they love it. They love the fact that it is happening,
yep.
But you need to provide people with the support to do it. I think you're a bit of an exception.
Okay. Sorry, Nick, and then you. I mean, just sort of echoing the previous point and sort of responding to yours, I mean, there's no way I would write an individual blog. I haven't got time. There's just too many other things to do. I've written 3 or 4 pieces for the public policy blog. For me, it's great to have somebody who can sort of tweak the title and do that sort of thing. And it seems to me the terms of trade are LSE is the umbrella which protects my academic freedom. My responsibility is to write stuff that I can stand up academically, but I don't regard that as a restriction. And LSE gives me more prominence under an LSE blog than I would get under an Iqbal blog. And I think it's a sort of win-win-win. Mm. Done well.
Good. I agree with everybody.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Helena Djokovic from the Political Studies Association. I just wanted to say that I just think there's so many other forms of communication. I must admit, I felt I came here under slight false pretense. I thought this was about communicating more widely, because I think blogging is important, but you went from you can still publish articles, journal articles, to blogging, and I think there's an awful lot in between. And I think the very important thing is also building relationships with journalists out there. And of course, blogging helps you enter into a dialogue, but there's a lot more. And I can see why, if you're not in London or the centre of where you have access to so many people, it's an important form of communication. I just think it's very important not to leave out the other element. I think.
So what would you
say? I think there is an important issue that what we have to do, ourselves as an association, all the other different universities and learned societies, is that issue of how do you learn to communicate and address the key issues. The problem with blogging is it's quite transient and it's very short term. You can start entering into debate, but it's not necessarily going to lead to long term changes in mindset or impact or of those things. So I think it's just important to consider all the other things, whether it's like writing papers that are written more in the way that think tanks write in a more accessible kind of language. I think it's important, the onus does exist on university and societies to do more training. But I think it's the language and building the links and getting out, making sure it's a dialogue and you're having a dialogue with policymakers and journalists and not just disseminating information. Yeah.
Okay, well, this is a great challenge. And I know you won't mind if I just come back to you about, you know, I'm a political scientist. The Political Studies Association is my association. I was on the executive for 12 years in the past. Justin's on the executive right now, so we've got a few people in there.
No, I haven't been for 7 years.
Well, he was on the executive for a long time. And, you know, the PSA fills me with absolute despair because they are just totally off the planet. You know, 85% of the money of the PSA comes from running a big, old-fashioned journal called Political Studies. When I was the editor of that, we managed to get Political Studies Review started, which you know, covers about 300 books a year and is a useful kind of thing. But recently, the PSA just set up a short article journal, for which they are charging people. I've written articles for it, but it's just a model that is so, you know, money grasping and last century in its orientation. I just don't know where to begin. There's not one single blog on the PSA website. There's no collective presence. So if we look at For example, what did the PSA do during the recent AV referendum, and what did we do? We ran 65 different blogs, and we're about to bring out the authoritative book of all those blogs. That's a sort of memorial tablet to the failure that was the AV referendum. But PSA managed to do, you know, one little press release or one little short report.
That's completely wrong. We did a report and 22,500 downloads of that paper. We ran media briefings.
One of our blogs on the AV thing got 13,000 alone. We had 65 blogs.
I'm not saying there isn't room for blogging. I'm just saying don't make it exclusive. And when you're talking about communication and impact, you need to.
But the difference is, you're old-fashioned and we're not.
So why did you make the book?
No, I think,
that's a good point. That's a very good point. And the answer is that there are dangers with a blog. I mean, the blog material is up there for, you know, if you're posting every day, it's up there for a day. And then it begins to move down the blog. So we have these 65 blogs. Some of them were accessed thousands of times, and others, you know, which was almost as good, just didn't quite zing it. So what we wanted to do was to pull it all together. So the coverage that we have, we're condensing into an e-book, and then we're publishing this as a free e-book, and we hope that every political science teacher who wants to teach the AV referendum what happened and so forth, this will be a window on the referendum. We're going to be doing that for every year in British politics. We'll publish an update ebook of all our past blogs and of all our past blogs in British policy as well. So I used to edit a book called Developments in British Politics, which, you know, took years to produce and lasted for four or five years, during which it went slowly out of date. Now we'll do an instant ebook every year. So I think things will get better, and also you'll see that the research content of 65 blogs massed together is a very substantial amount, because lots of people have, you know, one little thing that they want to say, one bit of expertise, and when you put it together you get a massing of expertise. So it was unfair to you to say that you're old-fashioned, but it is the case that it's very hard to get professional bodies to move and connect with.
I think one thing that people will recognise is an association. You cannot, you have to represent a wide range of views. And for something like Political Studies Association that has 1,800 members, you know, you can't strongly promote one point of view.
So you can't strongly do innovation, so you're always old-fashioned.
You can't strongly do innovation.
No.
The common point that emerges is in blogs, a lot of effort goes into simplifying the writing and communicating clearly. A lot of academic articles, a lot of online discussion papers, the writing is crap. And particularly in my field, economics, you know, where it's sort of just totally indigestible. And I think that's something that we should all be doing in the academic side of our writing, however active or otherwise we are on blogging.
I think there's a good example of that is the Centre for Economic Policy publishes a short article journal called Centrepiece, which is, you know, professionally written but rewritten by a writer from what economists produce, but it's very easy to use. So and similarly, the new Political Studies short article journal, Political Insight, is a great journal. It just should be an open web thing and not a closed web thing, because, you know, you're not going to get the readership.
We're looking at all of that. Just to come back on the point that you've made, it's not necessary to use a blog in order to write accessibly. So I mean, what you're suggesting is that many of us should actually learn to kind of write accessibly for different kinds of audiences. But you know, taking your point, it doesn't have to be the blog format. It could be any other format where we're actually recognising different kinds of audiences in terms of impact. But it is the case, I think, not just in economics, but you know, across all our sectors, in terms of kind of professionalising ourselves, in terms of trying to make our messages intelligible.
Good.
Yeah. I mean, we've just come back. I mean, if one says, in the old days, universities are about teaching and research, and now we're about teaching and research and knowledge transfer. The knowledge transfer bit of our remit requires us to be better communicators than in the old days when we merely communicated with fellow nerds where the shorthand was fine.
Sorry,
I just wanted to jump in because I just recently took over the LSE Media Policy Project blog, having never done this necessarily before in my life. the things that we're doing is actually putting up things like dossiers of resources, and today we just launched another policy brief. And these are bigger pieces that aren't actually in the blog. You blog that this is coming out, and then there's a link to the to sort of the bigger piece. And I'm trying to sort of negotiate. I mean, first of all, I need to redesign so that you can find things easier, but when I look back at what other journalists had cited, when they cited not the blogs, but the policy briefs, the last one that we went out, that's something that people can use as a resource and reference and things like that, whereas nobody's referenced one of our blogs, you know. So I'm wondering, how do you sort of set it up? How do you make a balance so that if you have a blog that also has something that can be a lasting resource, kind of LinkedIn, how can we do it? Right now I'm sort of using the blog to draw attention to this. We're blogging about other stuff as well, you know, but when we have these things, I want it to be something that people can actually find again afterwards and can serve as a resource that stays there.
Maybe I could just come back on that, because there are some really interesting points that you make. I mean, when we set up this blog at RSE, British Politics and Policy, there was no known way of recognising blogs in the LSE. Institutional recognition was sort of zero. So it wasn't in the library catalogue, it wasn't listed on the experts page for each LSE academic, it wasn't coming out on Google Scholar and so forth. So I think you can expect that if you set up this kind of blog or something like this, or even start with a new short article journal, that you'll have to do quite a lot of institutional fighting, but particularly if it's a blog, to get it recognised, so it's noticed by the library and by the electronic publications archive and so on. And so it took us about a year, I suppose, to get all these little hurdles removed, and now you can see all our blogs on Google, and they are beginning to be cited on Google Scholar as much as ordinary academics, and some people will cite the source, the blog itself, and other people will cite will go to the original thing that you're referring to. But I just wanted to ask you, LSE Media has had a great deal of success depositing things on Scribd, which does anybody know about Scribd? It's a big US document database where you can just upload all your stuff if you want people to read it. So sometimes you'll find that people have uploaded all your lecture notes without you knowing that they're up there, but, and indeed probably transcripts of your books as well. But Scribd is, you had some very good reactions on Scribd.
For instance, today with the PD policy brief that we did, and it's a short document with some key findings, a few 6 graphs, you know, not very long, in an understandable language with one key message, basically. And that goes on Scribd. We blog that it's happening with 2 quotes from Sonia Livingston, who was the author of this one, along with one of our colleagues. We filmed a short segment on YouTube with Sonia talking about it, which was a minute and a half long, and we put that. So the blog contains the link to the clip and a link to the document, which is in Scribd. And so the document isn't actually on our blog, actually. You can see it in a window. That's the whole thing. You can see it in a window, and you can scroll down. But if you actually want the document, you can click download, and it actually comes from Scribd.
Yeah.
You don't even have to... And then we also do a mass mailing with an announcement saying that it's there, and the link's also embedded with the clip and the document to our database of 400,000 people. Because it's a targeted blog. I guess we're not blogging to necessarily everybody. We're blogging to policymakers about, you know, a specific area.
Great.
Yeah.
Sorry, other comments.
Can I just ask first, is this it, as it were, for this session, or is there going to be another presentation that isn't about blogging?
No, I'm afraid this is it.
Okay, so we've got 25 minutes left to talk about blogging or some other aspect of improving.
Whatever you'd like to talk about.
Okay, well, what I would like, please, is for you guys to elaborate on how you think your blogs, which from all the conversation that's been going on seem to be very inward-looking in terms of within the academic community, I mean, to my mind, somebody being cited on Google Scholar is not evidence of communication to the outside world or the end users. How do you envisage that these blogs are actually going to achieve recorded and auditable occasions of influence from universities and academic people to the end users and the organisations? Could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, just to, this is sort of a starting point. What a lot of the WordPress system that we use allows us to track every time our blog is mentioned or an article is mentioned in any other website. So if it goes up on the Guardian Higher Ed for our Impact's blog that's helping to run this session today, or for example during the election we were quoted by various media outlets across the world, that will be linked through. So you're presented with a list of links generated on an hourly basis of things coming in. Likewise, with Twitter as well, we can see journalists talking about us, or other community groups, or policy groups, or think tanks citing us. So within the online domain, it's very, very easy to track what's happening. And as I was saying earlier, in terms of Google Analytics, you can then segment things and track who is reading you. So community organizations, government departments. Like, we know our blog's being read in Parliament. We know it's being read in the National Audit Office and the BBC, because that's what our things are telling us. Now, we don't know necessarily if it's been quoted in a internal policy report in any of those areas. But we
so you don't know if what people are making of it either. I mean, if they choose
sure.
to comment.
Sure.
But, I mean, that's all very well and good, and I'm not saying there isn't a role for blogging. There definitely is, and it's very valuable, and it's instant and all that kind of thing, which we all know is the way things are going. But in terms of achieving the kind of measurable impact that's being talked about in the first session this morning, I'm not quite clear how this is actually going to get us from where we are now to that, you know, to these measurable impacts and case studies and what have you. And that's really what I was hoping you would elaborate on. And okay, you can monitor who's reading it, you don't know what they're thinking about it. They might think it's a load of utter bollocks.
But that's true. It's not that this is blunderness, and what we really need is more precision. So this is what we're getting, lots of material, which is really the blunderness effect. What we're talking about this morning is being precise. If there's 20 people, there's two impact studies going forward. It's a bit more precise then. I got the same sort of feel that the two were quite blended.
Okay, that's an interesting point. I mean, I think the whole point is, if things are digital and electronic, you can actually focus a lot more on who's using them. So, for example, this is a new journal that David Held and I are editors of, and it's been online for 2 years now, and we can chart who's downloaded it. And so I can tell you that the top three institutions that download views are, first of all, LSE, then the University of Oxford, then the IMF, and World Bank is the third major downloader. And then if you go down the next people who've downloaded, the next six downloaders are all government bodies. Now, of course, and then we get to other universities below that. Now, of course, you can't absolutely prove that the people aren't downloading your articles in order to have a good laugh at them. They could be doing that. It's just highly unlikely that that's what they're doing. And, you know, if that's what you think, or if that's what the panel think, I don't think there's anything we could do about it. You know, it's a level of unbelievability that I just feel would be too fictitious words. On the whole, for example, there used to be a thing that said you can't trust citations because people might be citing things because it's negatively cited. We've looked at 16,000 articles and classed whether they were positive or negative citations, and the number of negative citations is so tiny it's almost invisible. So I think we're actually looking for some kind of perfectionist criterion of influence that's just not there. Do you say this was in the Times and it was read by 400,000 people but it had no influence? Because, you know, that seems to be the implication of what you're suggesting. Whereas we would say, if it's read, that's the first stage. It doesn't prove that absolutely people change their lives. But do you say that to a newspaper or a columnist or something? Prove to me that, your article changed people's way of thinking.
The position that academics are increasingly in, what I'm talking about is this thing about being measured on your research. I mean, no doubt they would be fired from their jobs or whatever if nobody ever read seems to me that we've got to take a bit further than that, because ultimately our whole futures depend on this impact thing. I mean, it's sort of a life or death situation, lots of people's jobs. So I'm just curious, that's all. I'm not trying to be a skeptic. I'm just saying, well, how could you use this blog to, you know, communicate directly, to set up meetings with people? I mean, can you follow it up and say, if you're interested in this, you know, contact me and I'll come and see you and explain our research in more detail? Or what would you suggest? Or what have you tried, if anything?
Okay, I think that's slightly, you know, unrealistic in the way of the way things go. I mean, I think what you're trying to do, first of all, is establish a general reputation. So, for example, during the AV campaign, I don't know how many journalists rang you up, but thousands rang us up. And we gave views and so forth that then were not credited to the blog. But the point is, we know perfectly well they would say to us, we've been reading this on the blog, what do you think about X, Y, and Z? So the first thing is that you're creating a general reputation. Secondly, within that general reputation, you're hopefully getting out research impact messages, or messages that have a potential for research impact, which wouldn't otherwise have got out before. So, as I've mentioned earlier, for example, most people in government don't have subscriptions to academic journals. If you published it in an academic journal, they'll never find out about it, except through looking at a Google web thing. And then all they can look at is the abstract. So if you publish an open web version of that, that's a much better way of converting initial readers of the title and the abstract into readers of the whole thing. So at each stage down the line, you're going to lose an awful lot of attrition. It's like a mail shot, you know. When people send out mail shots, these awful mail shots you get through the door, how many people respond? It's a 2% response rate. You've got low response rates here. You've got to... But that is the world as it is. You know, if you think that you're going to communicate with busy civil servants and policymakers and they're going to come back to you on the basis of one-to-one things, it's not usually the way it works.
Can I try answering that question?
Yeah.
What you need for impact for F purposes is something out there has got to be different because of a piece of published research you did. And the blog is in some ways the advertisement for the journal that gets...
Yeah.
A ministerial advisor to read the journal article, and I mean, it's that. It's not that this itself leads directly to impact because it's not published research.
But let's take you, Nick. You're Mr. Student Fees. It's all your fault, right?
Sorry, Gary.
So he's owning up to it. But can you prove it in the ref?
Good question. I mean, I'm doing an awful lot of scrabbling through emails, and it's then a question of what the ref rules will be. The answer is probably yes, but it will require quite a lot of work, because clearly the model on which this is based is, I work for, I'm a biochemist. I patent a new drug. The medical condition plummets as a result of the new drug. It's causal. It's one-to-one. It's
discovery research,
etc. Now, that model works very well for pharmaceutical drugs. It's not as simple in the social sciences because, yes, all right, I've had an impact on the higher education debate. Has it only been me? Of course not. There have been lots of other people. And, you know, the tightly knit causality of the social sciences isn't there.
Good, yes.
Sorry, I've had my hand up for so long, I hope that what I have to say is still relevant.
Sure it is.
I'm Maureen Benjamin. For the last 2 years at LSE, I've been piloting some knowledge transfer training. And it's covered four areas of policy writing, engagement with the radio, engagement with the press, communicating accessible language, writing monthly pitches, and also knowledge networking events. And the one thing that I know, well, there are two things that are really interesting. One is that the most effective way of engaging academics, because after all, I'm asking them to come to training that is taking up their time, is to combine training and networking. I think the two things, the relationship building and the training, have to go hand in hand, because you're looking at learning not only different languages for these different media outlets or different audience building outlets, but these are also different cultures. And so it's not just about being able to talk the language, it's about knowing who to talk to. And the two things work very well hand in hand. And the other thing that I wanted to mention just good academic. And many academics who do a great deal of transparency work or communication work will tell you the advantages they're teaching. And they'll also say that they get more play as an academic as a result of doing more transparency work and so forth. So, sorry, broadening it out again, I suppose, because my sense of blogging, and to narrow it down to blogging, is there are people who blog very well, and there are people who take to it very naturally. But there are a lot of academics who, you know, who'd rather do anything else rather than blog. You know, and I think there are lots of other ways to have effective knowledge transfer.
Good. Yes.
You talked a lot about monitoring and reading your blog and seeing it read by government. I just wondered what proactive work you've done to get it out there in the first place, to rather than publishing it and
we started during the general election, and then we converted an election blog into a British politics blog, so that's been our main thing. But we also have the impacts blog, and Jane, you know more about the impacts blog. How do we proactively get out there with the impacts blog?
We started the impact blog as part of this research project because we really wanted it to be an interactive process, and so we ask people to send in, obviously, blog posts, and we do quite a lot on Twitter, actually. And as a relatively new user to Twitter, I think, especially around impact, there's a real community of people who are using this tool in order to tell each other about the research that they're doing and events that are on and new news from FP World and things like that. And I think that's been a real interest to us, to watching how people use that. I mean, we use sort of normal publicity methods to raise the profile for the blog. I mean, some of it is actually asking people to contribute because it tells them that the blog exists and, you know, how many people are reading you and that they might quite like to get involved in this. So some of it has been sort of more traditional, normal media routes, but due to using the blog, because obviously it's quite easy for people to get access to it, to see what you're doing, to see the standard of the work that is shown on there, that, you know, you can see it's not sort of ranting, it's not celebrity gossip type things, you know, it really gives it a good example. And I think your point about how do we know that people are reading it, I mean, as Patrick said, we had a lot of contacts from the media during the AD referendum, and they all said, we found you because of the blog. So we know from sort of our own experience that this is how people are finding us now, and it may be that people didn't know how to find us quite before. We are also having a lot of contacts from government departments because they found us through the blog. So we really do get to see that side of it, that this means if you Google British politics, we're quite high up in really basic thing means you're more visible.
And then you can use a blog to promote conferences and things like this, as with this blog, which has been promoting this conference for a reasonably long time. So I think you're hoping that you'll get viral marketing, that people will retweet and email and spread it around, and add a range of different sort of layers of communication. And then if people get to participate as well, and there are a lot of contributors on the impact blog, we've got lots of. Oh, no, that's the wrong thing. Let me do it back to the right thing. So if you go back down the blog, you'll find lots of different contributors and lots of advert for other things. And you also hope that if you network with other things, then you'll be able to. And we like book reviews as well, which is another great thing. We started this on the British Politics blog because we didn't have anything to put up on Sundays, you know. We didn't want it to go to zero. And it's been surprisingly popular. So we're thinking of doing a new blog just devoted to social science book reviews and maybe even technology. Yeah.
I just want to come back to the point of the question about the woman firing this row about the interface between sort of blogging and rep. I was a bit skeptical. I was a bit disappointed that the whole session was about blogging. Not over me. But I realised that this whole conference is about impact and that there is a process that we are going to have to engage with. But I would despair if I had to think that every single activity that I was undertaking, I had to think in advance, okay, how is this going to be captured in the rep? myself tomorrow because you know, I'm a scientist and I'm a scientist because I'm curious about the world and I like doing science and I write a blog because I like to write it and I want to tell people about some of the work that I do and the things that I'm interested in. And actually the blogging is only actually factoring into the ref because people out there have gone out and created it, okay, as a sort of literary form or as a form of communication. And I would, although we have to engage with this process, I would urge us not to submit to it, you know, in quite such a callow way. You know, we have to be responsible, of course, for using taxpayer money, but, you know, let's try and seize hold of the agenda of it and try and drive it and create new ways in which we can demonstrate, you know, like the value of all the different sciences that we engage in for society.
Yes, great. Couldn't say it better.
I mean, I'm happy to stand up why I think it is right to have impact in the ref. I'm sure it is. On the other hand, as you say, it is only one of the things we ought to be doing. Knowledge for its own sake continues to be important. So I think we should engage with it, we should support it, but then we should fight for examples that 1 in 10 makes sense, 1 in 2, I would ask, could I have your gun after you're finished with it? You know, of course it's not all that we do, but it is part of what we do, and I think it's probably important, if only because if we don't justify what we do to the electorate, we ain't going to get the money.
I just wanted to speak up for humble blogging. Like, I'm so impressed with the LSE blogs, but they're huge, dynamic, powerhouse institutions, and I'm guessing there's some serious resources in terms of professional expertise and paid roles.
He's it.
There you go. I run a much more small-scale humble blog for an interdisciplinary research centre in a field that is not yet established. It's the medical humanities. And I just wanted to say that even at a very small scale level, which is not at the institutional level, it's not necessarily in, you know, in the hardcore social sciences, there are some really fantastic discipline building aspects of the blogging we do in terms of being able to capture a whole lot of the visiting academics that we have come to speak at the centre, inviting them to be guest authors, and in terms of engaging with the local communities that we work with. So we have work with a lot of work with primary schools and a number of arts and health projects in primary schools, and actually getting the people from the primary schools to contribute their photographs and stories to the blog, which the great advantage of it is that it's a WordPress blog and we don't have to go through Central University IT.
Yeah.
So the whole kind of communication interface that, you know, that is, in the case of my institution, somewhat vexed by a very, very clunky and very kind of centrally administered IT system, is circumvented by a blog that can build, can actually contribute, can get content from visiting academics who aren't necessarily part of our direct research team, but also from the communities and external partners that we work with.
Yep.
So you don't have to worry about documenting how people thought about the event and the program that you did, because they've already sought out a way to make themselves visible to that.
Yep.
And that's just, it's so rewarding. Like, it's the most enchanting thing to actually have people not just write you an email and say, that was fantastic, but comment on, you know, what they made of something in a way that's publicly accessible. So the humble blog can be good too.
Absolutely.
My comment.
Yep. Thank you very much, and thanks to all of you for the contributions. I'm sorry if anybody feels that they came here under a mislabeling of apologies, but we're now moving to the final session, and that's taking place in the big theatre.